Doctors Brock and Fernette Ide live and work in Edmonds, Washington, where they have a national referral practice specializing in neuro-learning. Their book, The Mislabeled Child, Looking Beyond Behavior to Find the True Sources and Solutions for Children's Learning Challenges, offer this information aid to labeling and dealing with various brain-based learning challenges. Each of the 11 chapters focuses on a single type of learning system and the challenges that affect it, overlooking the obvious visual problems in children, getting it all together, attention problems in children, making the right connections, autism and autism-like disorders. Dr. Fernette and Dr. Brock Ides, welcome to It's Your Health.
Hi there.
Glad to be here.
In the beginning of your wonderful book, The Mislabeled Child, you include an ancient Chinese proverb, wisdom is calling things by their right name. Why did you choose this proverb? What does that mean to you?
Well, I think one of the main reasons that we wrote the book was that we were concerned about the fact that the approach to children who were having learning and behavioral problems was based excessively just on looking at observable behaviors rather than looking at the causes of the behaviors. And we were concerned that that so many kids were funneled into a few narrow diagnoses that simply categorize their behavior. So kids that were having problems paying attention were labeled with attention deficit disorder. Kids that were having problems, being obedient were given the oppositional defiant disorder label. Kids that were having problems with social interactions were labeled as autistic. And we thought it was a better approach to really look, from our bias neurologically, to try to see how kids were processing information, to see what the source of the behaviors were, rather than just stopping at the level of observable behavior.
Often very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Like, for example, my daughter has gotten several different labels. She's gotten Asperger's. She's gotten, profoundly gifted. She's gotten sensory processing disorder. She's gotten anxiety disorder.
Yeah, and that cluster that you mentioned for your daughter is a very common one. Mm-hmm. And again, at the level of behavior look at the diagnostic rating scales for example, Asperger's and the newer scales that are dealing with sensory processing disorder, as you mentioned, there's a huge overlap. And we also do have a chapter in the book on the issues that go along with being a gifted child. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of an unusual approach to put a gifted chapter in a book on learning disorders, but there are definitely challenges that go along with being a gifted child. Things develop at such different rates in gifted kids. They can be intellectually at one point, emotionally at another point, and physically at a different point, and that makes a confusing mix.
Yeah, that's my daughter right there. And it's so, when people hear the word gifted, they often think you're bragging. And I always have to say, no, I'm not bragging. That just happens to be what it is. But there are issues. And it seems like often kids who are gifted tend to have some other issues as well. I'm on a support group through Yahoo for gifted kids with special needs. And it seems like they all have the same types of labels that you mentioned in the beginning, ADHD and oppositional defiance disorder or OCD or it's really interesting.
When they've actually done some studies, even just looking at IQ and some of the cortical thickness things, it's kind of an interesting pattern too, because when they looked at the higher the IQ, it looked like the more late blooming certain areas, like the executive function, the attention organizational areas, were actually developing in young children kind of behind the norm. And then they kind of spurted, and they surpassed the other kids when it came to be about the 11th or 12th. So it was really a very different developmental profile just on the basis of IQ, making them look as if they had attention deficit disorder, whereas it was really the pattern of development. And, things like that are really important to keep in context. What are the different variations that happen among gifted kids? What are the different sensitivities and not making everything a disorder?
Yeah, that's true. It does seem like everything. I mean, people say that to me now. They say, when we were growing up, you didn't hear these labels, except I think back and I think to a lot of kids that they would have called quirky, and it makes me wonder, did they have more issues but people just weren't aware of them, or are we over-labeling? And apparently sounds like we're mislabeling.
Yeah, it's, comparing generations with each other, you know, is difficult in some ways, because I think there's a lot more assortive mating now. You know, studies have suggested that more people in our generation, as parents, marry people with like processing styles. That you know, Fernet and I met together as physicians. You know, we see a lot of two engineer marriages, or engineer with mathematician, whereas in the past, you know, those were less frequent. And so it's confusing comparing generations, but there's no question that the changes in the DSM itself, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, which categorizes a lot of the behavioral disorders, the changes in that over time have contributed to the increase in labeling for kids. The categories have gotten more numerous over time, and the diagnostic criteria for each of those categories has gotten more inclusive as time goes by, just swelling the numbers.
Yeah, well, you know, Ida Zelaya, who runs something called Sensory Street, and she fills in for me from time to time, she emailed me and said she wanted me to talk to you guys about, you know, you mentioned the DSM, and that right now, Dr. Lucy Jane Miller, who's trying to get sensory processing disorder in the DSM, and you have a chapter on that, and it seems to be a controversial diagnosis. What's your feelings on that?
Well,
the phenomenon is not controversial.
Yeah,
I mean,
and that's a real issue. I mean, there are definitely large numbers of kids that do experience difficulties with sensory processing, and getting a diagnosis of sensory processing disorder listed in the DSM is you know, the approach that Lucy's taken to dealing with that situation. We have our own sort of way of looking at these kids. A lot of the behaviors and a lot of the physical signs and symptoms that we see with those kids that have the SPD label are probably referable to difficulties with cerebellar processing. And recent studies across the whole learning disorder spectrum, kids, you know, with dyslexia, kids with sensory processing symptoms, kids with autism spectrum symptoms, kids with attention deficit, very commonly kids from all those categories will show some signs of cerebellar processing dysfunction. And what we're looking at is probably a combination of developmental and genetic factors on the one hand, and consequences of birth stress, early life, infections, NICU stays, and things like that, causing delays in cerebellar development. And so irrespective of what it's called, the physical phenomena are very real. There's a neighbor of yours there at Massachusetts General Hospital, a neurologist named Jeremy Schmaman, who's created a diagnosis that he calls cerebellar cognitive affective disorder, that he noted in kids that he had seen that had tumors in their cerebellums that were removed. And these kids come out looking very much like kids with sensory processing disorder, kids on the autism spectrum disorder, and their cerebellar lesions are very easily defined. And so we're probably really looking at kids with some of the same basic underlying physiological challenges. And irrespective of what labels you use, it's a very real physical phenomenon.
Now, go ahead.
It might have been also, the sensory system is always the deviled neurologist, too. I mean, it's a difficult thing to quantitate. And when you're talking about behaviors that are linked to sensory systems that you can't quantitate, you can't get a blood test and say, oh, you know, it looks like balance is off, you know. And because of that, I mean, it really does make it the burden of proof, you know, on the parents who see them in certain environments, and on the clinician, you know, who has to compare them to other children. And that's in an office visit, which makes it a difficult thing.
Yeah, it does. It does. And, you know, I know from my own experience, when my daughter first got the diagnosis of SPD, of sensory processing disorder, it seemed like it wasn't enough for people, or they still didn't quite get it. And then once we finally got the Asperger's, then people were like, oh, okay. And I just thought, God, there needs to be more understanding, because it shouldn't matter what the label is. If your child is having difficulties and struggling, your child's having difficulties and struggling.
You're right. That additional Asperger label sometimes means, oh, it's really...
She wasn't just exaggerating.
You know, but the problem is all the assumptions that can come with an Asperger's label.
That's true.
Inappropriate, you know, so it's a really tricky business. What do people think you mean, you know, when you add that on?
Tricky part. Yeah, and also, you know, when you start the book after, I love that quote that we talked about in the beginning, the proverb, but you talk about a boy named Michael who was really bright and talented, but soon after he started school, it was clear he had some learning difficulties, and you related a conversation that Michael had with his mother where she asked him to describe himself, and he says he's not smart, and he's maybe even below average, maybe even stupid or at times worthless. And this is so heartbreaking, and I've known some people through the group that I'm in that have similar stories, and it's just, especially when the child's in school and they have a teacher who doesn't understand or the other children pick on the child. How often do you see this, and what can be done in the schools to help teachers understand that these children really are, you know, wired differently and how these issues are real?
This is a very frequent problem. I mean, we see kids that have really profound problems with their self-image, and Michael now is in his upper teens, and he's still really dealing with issues of depression and low self-esteem. A brilliant young boy, and he's going to grow up and be a fantastic engineer, but he really is still dealing with some of those issues. And the hardest thing for kids when they're coming through the school system is having people really doubting that they're trying their hardest, that they're doing their best, that they're really doing everything they can to learn, and not just loafing or not just failing to apply themselves. And it's very important for teachers, especially in the early grades, to understand that the kids really do develop in very different ways, that there is not a single uniform norm of development. You don't have uniform milestones that apply to every child, and that a failure to develop skills in the same way is not necessarily a result of lack of application or lack of intelligence, but may reflect a very different processing style. So it's really important for teachers to understand how different kids develop and how they can process information in different ways, and that, you know, the child with severe dysgraphia or the child with difficulty learning to read or the child with difficulty following auditory instructions may really be struggling in those areas because of differences in their neurological development and not the lack of effort.
Now, what is dysgraphia?
Dysgraphia is just a general term meaning difficulty with written expression, and it can apply primarily to problems making neat and legible handwriting, or problems of a broader nature, getting one's thoughts out in writing. It's multifactorial in its causes. There's a lot of different potential causes of dysgraphia, so it's kind of a general category. Like dyslexia is, there are a lot of different patterns for struggling readers and for struggling writers, and again, it's important to get beyond just a general categorization to look specifically at what the problems the child's having to find the right solution.
Yeah, you know, another thing too that you wrote in your book that I thought was so helpful is that, you know, it's really important that for children who have, you know, who struggle with these learning challenges, to have an adult who believes in them totally and unfailingly. And I know that sometimes some parents get frustrated, which is normal. And sometimes that frustration, the child can interpret that they're, you know, not trying hard enough, even if the child's, I mean, the parent's trying to be supportive. So I think parents as well as teachers need some education. It's really tough on everybody.
That's absolutely true. Dysgraphia particularly, because, you know, the children are clearly smart. The information goes in, and then you ask them for their ideas, and, you know, they can really struggle organizing that into words. Some of these kids are strong visual learners. They process in images. It's a late blooming profile, and it's real hard to organize those images and sensations and feelings and put them out into words. And so they're often being underestimated, and it looks like they're not trying.
Yeah, and I think if you have a child that they label as gifted, they especially get, well, you're just lazy, or you're not trying, or... You know, I know with my brother, he's profoundly gifted, and, you know, he had all kinds of troubles in school, and, you know, it just, he got so much flack. Now, this was back in the 70s, of course, But it just seems like these things are still going on. So it's so great that there's people like you out there who are educating folks. Now, I have some questions from some listeners. I put up on my site, they saw that you were coming, and I asked people to mail in questions. So this is a question from Melissa. And she says, my son is 6 years old and has ADD and couldn't hear for the first 2 years of his life due to a cleft palate and 2 sets of tubes. He is very intellectual and knows more than we know he does. He's like the unlocked genius. However, he has a difficult time putting it down on paper or saying it aloud to his teacher. When he is at home, he seems to do much better. We've literally tried everything, and the teachers are literally putting their hands up and telling us to hire a tutor to work with him 5 days a week for 3 hours a day. What I would like to know is what would be a good exercise for us to work with him on getting him to process it on paper and not just keeping it in his head. And it's funny because you were just talking about that. And she says, we started the Orton Gilliam learning system with him, with a professional, because traditional learning techniques do not seem to be working with him. Would you suggest this technique of learning? And she hopes these questions are clear enough.
Difficulties with learning writing and also learning to read for kids that have had early life hearing impairments are pretty common. And it would be helpful for Melissa to look on both sides of the family also and see if there's a potential family contribution to some of the difficulties with reading and writing as well, because there's often a strong genetic component. So most commonly what we see is there's a meeting of a genetic susceptibility to problems with learning, reading, and writing combined with some environmental impact as well, early life ear infections or the cleft palate in her son's case. The Orton-Gillingham approaches are the very standard basic approaches that have developed out of the field of dyslexia and dyslexia research, and those are an excellent place to start for kids that have problems learning, writing, and reading because of sound-based disorders. There are some of the Orton-Gillingham approaches that combine using training for hearing to improve the processing of speech sounds by the auditory cortex, the part of the brain that processes speech sounds, and couples those with practice saying the sounds very clearly. So, and those are often very good approaches for kids with auditory processing intake problems as well. So, things like the Linda Mood Bell lips system is often a good approach, and linguistic remedies is another newer approach.
Well, 6 is also fairly young for a lot of writing expectations from a child.
That's true.
What's really lacking at young gifted child, weak on the auditory processing side, is that they might have so many ideas. Their rapid back and forth speaking or discussing is on the weak side. They're not interacting back and forth. They come out with this whole explosion of things that they're thinking about, and they're not responding to what you've said or things like that. And they're not organizing their ideas in a sequence. And so, putting your finger on that a little bit first, seeing whether there's some problems organizationally with speaking, with telling a story, will be important than putting it out in writing by hand. Allow them to scribe, allow them to organize their work, or code switching is another issue too, very common among gifted children. How to know what to say to your next door neighbor, how to know what to say to someone who's an expert on the subject, things like that. What words do you use, what do you think, do you have to ask them about, do you know about this movie before you start talking about it, things like that can be really helpful if a parent gives them some idea back and forth rather than sometimes let them just say whatever they want.
Yeah, I have another question. Jill from Canton, Georgia asks, how should parents talk to their child's teacher about ways he or she can accommodate the child's particular learning style?
It's very important to initiate that conversation is the very first response I would make. Parents definitely shouldn't be shy if they have a child who has a very strong learning preference, and it's very helpful for teachers to know if your child has, for example, a lot of difficulty hearing in noisy or busy environments, so that they might need printed backup, or they might need an occasional touch on the shoulder to you know, get their attention. You know, if your child really struggles with certain aspects of written output but can do much better orally, you know, if there are very pronounced difficulties reading small text but much less difficulty reading larger text, or worksheets that have fewer problems on them, it's very important to approach teachers with these things. And you know, fairly often you can arrange accommodations without going through a very large process with the school if the numbers of things needed are are small and the teacher is relatively cooperative. If there is a problem getting the accommodations, though, parents shouldn't be slow either in seeking to go through the administrative channels to get a 504 for accommodations for the child. You know, don't worry that the teacher is going to be offended or that the school is going to be angry with you or whatever. It's just, you know, at this point, a lot of teachers feel inundated by requests and they may not feel like they have the capacity to do things. You know, it's sort of a triage approach. They'll go first to the ones who seem to be struggling the most, and you know, if your child is not one of the ones that grabs their attention, their issues may be overlooked. So it's important for parents to be proactive you know, to gradually keep sort of going up the ladder, you know, if the need is still there and the needs are not being met.
Now, is it also important to get an IEP? And if you can tell listeners what that is, if they're not familiar.
An individualized education plan. An IEP usually needs a higher threshold of being behind age norms. And so sometimes the schools will tell you two grades behind. For gifted kids, that they often won't qualify for the IEP, but they may qualify for the 504. And the 504 generally, you know, is not as organized or detailed a process, but can also get a child accommodations, for instance, for reading or for writing. But they don't have to fall two grades behind.
Okay. Now, Sarah from Chicago asks about her daughter who has ADHD, and she says that without medication, it takes her a really long time to do her school and homework, and it's tough on everyone involved, and they don't want to have to rely on meds, but they don't know what else to do. So she wondered if you had any advice and what your feelings are on using medication.
So we've seen a number of kids who do benefit on medication, usually in association with, a lot of scaffolding by parents or by tutors, organizing time, planning time, so that kids can experience some success. In a lot of situations, with a combination of the two, they might be able to hold off an increase in the medications as they get older, and then even be able to discontinue the medications after a while. So in some cases, it really can be helpful, helpful with a child combined with outside things, like I said, you know, that are supportive of their success in school. Getting them the appropriate accommodations if there was an unrecognized other disability like dysgraphia, for instance. And then, you know, then a child doesn't have to be on medications lifelong, but for a period of time, it really helps. I think it's something like at least half of the children who end up starting medications for ADHD have discontinued it within 2 years. So it's that rate of needing it forever.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the setting also where the medicines seem to be the most effective is in kids that have problems with either a very narrow working memory span, or kids that are especially susceptible to overload their working memory span because of difficulties doing things automatically, doing things without having to think about them. So when you see a child that really responds extremely well to the medications, there very commonly will be other things going on, as well as just attention issues. It's very common for kids with a really strong response to have some dyslexia-related issues or difficulties with dysgraphia at a basic level. So where you're seeing them overloading their working memory frequently is in tasks that require them to put together a lot of functions at the same time. And probably the most taxing ones are written output and math. And kids that are overloading a lot during those subjects, you can often scaffold their approaches to work. When it comes to writing, help them to learn to do things in stages, so they're not trying to come up with their ideas. Think of how to organize the words and sentences and paragraphs, remembering how to spell the words and remembering how to write the letters all at once. Kids that are overloading their working memory a lot frequently benefit from using keyboard rather than writing by hand. When it comes to doing math, if they have math mnemonics that allow them to easily remember the steps, for example, in long division or other complex problems, that can allow them to do work stepwise. That can help cut down on the working memory overload. So for a child that really shows a big difference in their performance on medicines, what you want to try to do in addition is help them learn how to scaffold their work, so they're not trying to do too many different processes all at the same time, and that can cut down on the frequency of overloading their working memory.
Oh, that's great advice. Now, Shirley from Chapel Hill, North Carolina asks, how do you feel about homeschooling, especially for children who are gifted? Because she has a daughter, she said that is, and is trying to figure it out.
Great. I mean, we're big fans of homeschooling, being homeschooling parents ourselves. Our son has been homeschooling with us in second grade. He's now in ninth grade. And in his case, his homeschooling was prompted both by very large asynchronies between his areas of strength and his areas of challenge. He's currently taking some college courses and some courses that are probably a couple years behind his actual grade level. Has real problems with written expression. Had a lot of problems at school with sensory processing issues, so he was overloading with the noise and the busyness of the environment, and has really thrived at home. So for appropriate kids, homeschooling is a very good option. And again, kids with big gaps between what they do well and what they have more difficulty with are great homeschooling candidates, as are kids with sensory processing issues.
Now, do you use a curriculum that, I mean, is there one out there? I mean, there's probably several out there. Do you design your own, or do you take a little bit from different curriculums? How does that work?
We're pretty eclectic.
I bet.
Especially as he's gotten older, we wanted to have, outside teachers, even though we're homeschooling. It's really everything kind of out of the home. A lot of online classes, other people's expectations for deadlines, which we thought was important for him. Having to take tests with other students, do discussions, and really it's a fantastic time for homeschoolers, because you can take college courses. Our son and I are going to be doing an online course, justice course from Harvard with Michael Sandel, that they've completely posted on YouTube videos where they have discussions. Yeah, it's a fantastic course. I wish I had taken that when I was a Harvard undergrad, and it's just so neat to be able to do that, to discuss. It's a moral reasoning course, to look at different moral dilemmas and a lot of talking points, but a lot of interaction between the teacher and Harvard students, and it's just fantastic what's available out there. For kids who are really advanced in mathematics, they can take advanced math topics that you can't get in K-12 curriculum. So there's things out there that really have, fantastic possibilities. And I think that's why some really top-tier schools like Stanford have a higher acceptance rate for homeschooled applicants than non-homeschooled applicants. I mean, it's a very different profile.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I know that one issue when I talk to some parents is that they worry about the socialization aspect, but I've heard that there's tons of groups and you get together with other kids. It's not like you're sitting down in a basement somewhere studying. I think the image is people don't really understand, so it's good to get the word out.
Yeah.
So we only have a couple minutes left. I wanted to ask you about your ID NeuroLearning Clinic.
Uh-huh.
You can tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, we see kids here in Edmonds, which is just north of Seattle, and we do sort of a combined examination where we spend a lot of time with the parents as well as with the children, and I think that's probably been one of the most beneficial aspects of the fact that that Burnett and I work together, is that we get much more face time with the parents, and I think probably as much of our learning about the important role that that family history and family environment play in the educational development of the kids has come from just the structure of our practice. You know, one of us is in with the child while the other is out with the parents, and then we switch off. We work with families based on an assessment and the history and background of the child to develop a comprehensive learning report for the child, which describes you know, what therapy should be pursued, if any, what further assessments and evaluations are needed by other practitioners, and what things should be done by the school, and also what sort of approach to take with the school, what level of intervention is needed, et cetera.
But also, we look at a child's motivations, temperament, and learning style, learning strengths. You know, what are the things that they do very well, and you know, are there ways to use those strengths to overcome challenges, specific challenges?
Oh, that's great. God, there is so much more to talk about. I definitely want to have you back again soon. I want to thank you so much for coming on. And if you can tell us, how can people learn more and get in touch with you?
Probably neurolearning.com, and we're pretty accessible by email, too.
Oh, that's, I think you're going to get a lot of emails. I mean, like I said, we just skimmed the surface. You have so much great information. I encourage everyone to go out and get your book, The Mislabeled Child. It's so important, and I want to thank you both, and I hope you have a wonderful day. Now, if you want to reach me, go to itsyourhealthradio.org, and in about a minute or two, we're going to be joined by Mary Sue Williams and Sherry Schellenberger, the Alert Gals, so keep listening, and they're just going to be talking to us for about 10 minutes about an upcoming conference and also a little bit about self-regulation and the other things that they do. So everyone have a great week, keep being healthy, and stay tuned. We'll be back in a minute.